is The End User, episode 141 for Tuesday, July 23rd, Jumping Off the Next Edge. Hello and welcome to The End User, the show where we get together and talk about our experience with consumer technology with a bit of news from your perspective. The End User.
It's the tech news that you can use.
I am your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime, Taylor Marr. Chris, we skipped last week because I was out of town.
I promised people if they guessed who was traveling, which one of the co-hosts was traveling, that they would get to tune in next week.
Did anybody guess?
No, I don't think anyone guessed.
Well, that would explain why no one's tuning in then. Anyway, but while we were gone, the big news seems to be that all of the U.S. Cellular carriers are following T-Mobile's lead and offering a new contract upgrade plan, right? They're trying to give you an option that lets you pay not very much for your cell phone, but get a new cell phone every year or 6 months in some cases.
Right. So the I find the reaction to this to be a little bit surprising. I mean, I understand that almost all the major carriers, and we can get into a little more detail in a second here, but just I understand that all the major carriers in the U.S. here are offering this. And what this really is a service that lets you switch phones more quickly, and thus you pay more money, right?
Right. That's pretty much what it comes down to, yeah.
And so people out there were surprised by this for some reason. I get the kind of righteous knee-jerk reaction thing, but I'm a little bit surprised that people thought that they were going to get some kind of good deal by getting a greater convenience. You know, usually yeah. It's the opposite.
If you want to upgrade your phone more frequently than the two-year contracts that we currently have in the U.S., the cheapest way for you to do that is to buy the phone off contract, then buy whatever new phone you want whenever it comes out, and sell your old one.
Right. That's probably true just about anywhere, I have to imagine.
But
and if you do the upgrade within a year or so, you can get a decent penny back from selling it.
Exactly, because people are willing to pay for that, either someone else doing what you're doing, but buying a phone a year after it came out because they get a better deal, which you, that's what you do, Chris, generally. You buy phones off contract, right?
Right. Well, I've got a really old Verizon contract, and that gives me unlimited data for what is now become a small amount of money per month.
Right. So, it's a pretty sweet deal.
By buying off contract and saving about $30 a month, that $400 or $500 phone pays for itself pretty quickly.
Yeah. And you can do that to an extent with new plans as well, but you have to pay anywhere from $400 to $800 for your phone, as opposed to these new plans where T-Mobile wants you to pay $150 for a new phone, and you can upgrade as often as every 6 months, whereas AT&T's new plan called Next or Verizon's plan called Edge will let you trade in your phone and get a new phone for free, provided that you buy into their newer, more expensive plan.
So it's funny because I think T-Mobile kicked this off, and they clearly have the lowest over the lifetime of the phone and contract compared to AT&T and Verizon.
Right. T-Mobile was sort of offering it's still not necessarily cheaper, but it was sort of value proposition. You have a plan where more value goes toward your phone, but you're still paying more in the long run. AT&T and Verizon, what they're doing basically is saying, pay us this much money and get whatever phone you want whenever. It's a convenience fee to just always have the newest phone.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly it. It's a convenience fee. That's perfect.
Right. So all three of them have these plans. We've got some links in the show notes which show you why they're not a good deal in the long run. But if you're someone who's into paying a convenience fee every single month, in perpetuity, then by all means, check out these new plans. In the meantime, Sprint, the fourth major U.S. carrier, is doubling down on the old kind of plan, and that is pay whatever it was you were paying before and get unlimited forever. They're saying as long as Sprint is around, we are going to offer unlimited service. You know, you can always have unlimited data. You can pay for limited or unlimited minutes, and you can pay for unlimited text messages. And it's actually starting to look like a better deal at this point.
Yeah, it really is. They're saying it's starting on July 12th, and it's going to be $80 a month. That's about what I pay for my old Verizon plan. So that's quite the deal. Their service is a little spotty, but as long as you live in a major city, that's fine.
Yeah, I've never had significant problems with Sprint service except for when I moved out to the country for a while and there was no Sprint service. And I just had to leave.
What Sprint service?
What's Sprint? So I think we've covered the basics of all of these plans. There are a lot more details to them, but it's basically you're going to pay more money. If you're interested in that, you're going to have to figure it out on your own, because I don't want to, and I'm sure that you don't, Chris.
No, you'll have to whip out the calculator and do the calculation for yourself. But, you know, it boils down to if you want to pay a convenience fee, then you get the latest and greatest phone more often.
True. And if you don't live in the U.S., then you don't care at all.
That's right.
Well, so should we move on?
Yeah, let's get into our second story of the week. Give us a start.
All right, Google Maps has refreshed basically every platform. The first and perhaps biggest news was a long-awaited update to iOS. They added iPad support, which is great. They added Street View, indoor maps when available, bike directions, which are hugely important to me, and the ability to download maps for offline viewing, which is kind of an Easter egg. You just basically select the area on the screen that you want to be downloaded, and you type OK Maps into the search bar.
Yeah, and I really like the kind of aesthetic they're going for. It's this kind of new modern design thing that we've seen over and over again, where all of the entire UI is kind of flat, and it's not really trying to emulate real-world objects, but it looks nice to me. Although, you know, I don't have an iOS device to try it out on.
Yeah, it's actually, it's looked pretty much like that since they introduced it for iOS. But they have also rolled that new design out to the web interface. So it's completely revamped. It looks totally different. If you're using Google Maps for iOS, it will seem familiar to you. But if you hadn't been, it's pretty great. They announced some new developer tools so that Google Maps can be more integrated into different apps and APIs. And they let you zoom out all the way into space instead of the old thing where it would just show you a map of the world like three times around. I don't know. Does everybody else zoom out on Google Maps and see what's up? Now it looks like a globe, which is interesting.
Yeah,
and there are some other new things that we've got an article from TechCrunch where they talk about all the new things. But then they've also gone ahead and updated the Android app, and it's got everything that the iOS app and the desktop app have, but then even more stuff because Android seems to be their primary point of development for the latest cutting-edge Google Maps stuff.
Yeah, of course it is. It makes sense. That's Google's operating system, so of course they get the stuff, the new stuff more quickly.
So I haven't tried out the Android version, but the web version is pretty great. Having the new Google Maps on my iPad is great. Having bike directions, which Android users have had for a while, is great. So lots more Google Maps. If you use Google Maps, you're pretty much guaranteed to have a new interface since 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, no matter what platform you're using, web included.
Right. So I was pretty excited about that.
Well, so the status of Google Maps on Windows Phone is still a little uncertain. They allow you to use it in a web browser, and there's a bunch of third-party ones in the marketplace, but there's not an official client. Now, the clients that are third-party that are in the marketplace are actually pretty good. So we're not getting these official updates here on Windows Phone, but there's actually pretty good clients out there anyway.
Have you noticed any differences in them since the new web update?
No, they've looked all the same.
They all look the same.
Yeah, or at least the one third-party app that I've been using for Google Maps looks the same. There's at least four or five of them out there, and they're all called Google Maps, so it's a little confusing. So anyway, speaking of Windows Phone, let's get into some Windows Phone news. We've got the Nokia Lumia 1020 coming out. And have you gotten a look at this one?
I haven't really had much of a chance to look at it. I hear the camera is supposed to be amazing. And, first of all, this is a Windows Phone, right?
Right. So it's Windows Phone 8. It's kind of their next flagship device. So this isn't an also-ran that's coming out that's cheaper or anything. This is actually the newest flagship device. And it looks pretty cool. The biggest feature that people are talking about is the camera on it. If you look at the pictures in the link in the show notes, we've got The Verge has some photos of the thing. And the camera really bumps out of the back. It's almost like it's a real camera with a phone attached. But, you know, it's still pretty slim for what it's worth.
Sure, yeah. It does kind of look like a point-and-shoot camera.
Yeah, a little bit, right? It looks like it has a real lens on it. You know, it's actually got a decent camera in there. I mean, a lot of the smartphone cameras, including mine and your iPhone cameras, they're not quite up to snuff. And I wonder if this is going to change the picture there. So the biggest thing people are talking about is the 41-megapixel camera. And, of course, that's absolutely insane, and you wouldn't want to actually capture 41 megapixels from a sensor that is so small on the back of a phone like this. But I think the idea, at least this is what they're saying, is that you're going to take a picture and then you're capturing all the data you possibly can, and that way you can digital zoom afterwards and stuff like that.
Okay, interesting. But this isn't like the Lytro camera. You can't change the focus after the fact.
No, no. And, you know, maybe we'll see that one day, but the Lytro requires a cylinder shape, so I'm not sure how you would fit something like that. But it's kind of the same idea where you're just saying, listen, I'm going to take in all the data I can, and we're going to see what we can do with the picture afterwards. So, you know, you're not going to be able to adjust the focus, obviously, but those two ideas are one and the same.
I see. Okay. Well, we've heard a lot about this 41-megapixel Nokia camera. We've seen it in a couple of their other minor phones, so bringing
the
Symbian flagship
phone
is pretty impressive, and it's nice that they offer about as many adjustable settings as possible in the phone interface.
Right, so they've got a custom app that allows you to use this this device or this camera. So I was kind of interested to see that they are including ISO and focus and shutter speed and all kinds of other settings, and what's even more interesting is that a lot of those settings are just in Windows Phone in the first place. So,
are they? So you have that on your phone already?
Yeah. So, for example, you can adjust the ISO on my 8X here from 100 to 800. And you know,
that's pretty cool.
Granted, the camera on this device is not what this camera on the Lumia is, but yeah, I've got like white balance and exposure and saturation and ISO and all these kinds of settings. So a lot of those are already in there, but Nokia is going above and beyond with their customizations.
Sure. Well, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I'm excited to see. I'm excited to see what is happening with this thing. It's a pretty nice looking device. Now, last thing here, the one thing I'm a little sad about is that there is no built-in wireless charging. You have to get a separate little plate to get wireless charging on this device, unlike the last Lumia device.
Ah, really? I guess they couldn't fit it in with all that camera stuff.
Yeah, I suppose not. Or I think they figured out that not a lot of people used it. and they're just saying, okay, well, it's going to be your option. That's kind of the sense I get of it. But that's kind of disappointing. I really like the wireless charging on my phone, and I wish all phones had that.
I guess you're a little bit of a futurist yourself, Chris.
I suppose so.
It's lonely living ahead of the times.
Ahead of the curve?
Yeah, it can be a little bit sad. Be glad that you have the phone now. Probably in 2 years, every phone will have it.
Yeah, probably. Unless it's like FireWire. Or no,
it's
sorry.
Probably not like FireWire.
Unless it's like eSATA.
It's probably not like that either.
All right, so let's get into our last top news story of the last 2 weeks. And this one's going to be relatively quick, but Microsoft has released a version of Outlook for iOS. Isn't that exciting?
Right. This is a new addition to part of their Office app that they released in June that requires a subscription to Office 365.
Right. And it looks really interesting to me. I think there's some notion of, okay, this is your work app. You know, you're going to dive into this thing. You're going to have a separate calendar and contacts. And this is where your work life is. It's in this Outlook for Office 365 app. And then, you know, the rest of your device is all yours. Don't worry about it. But the app is PIN code protected, and it brings along its own calendar and contacts. I think that's really, I wouldn't have thought of that as being a thing, but it seems like a good idea to me.
Yeah, and then it only supports one Exchange Server account. So they definitely are not aiming to have this be your only full-time email account on your iPhone.
Right.
Unless you happen to only use your work-based Exchange email account.
Or Office 365 in this case.
Well, yeah, you need the Office 365 subscription, but I think you also need an Exchange account to run the email.
So the iPhone still supports Exchange through their regular mail app, don't they?
They do, yes.
So if you want to use an Exchange server, like an on-premises server that you've got in the closet, I believe you have to use the Apple app for that and do Exchange Active Sync in that way. But this thing is not for that. So Office 365 is kind of like Exchange, but it's in the Microsoft cloud. So that's a subtle distinction, I think, but it's worth noting. So does them rolling out an app that has a Metro Microsoft app look and feel bother you at all?
No, not really. It doesn't surprise me at all, and it doesn't particularly bother me. I think it will be a little bit incongruous, but less so when iOS 7 comes out.
Yeah, I guess that's true. I didn't think of that because iOS 7 is going to be a huge change, in fact, in this direction. So actually, when iOS 7 comes out, they'll be a little bit more in line with what the operating system looks like in the first place. So that's kind of interesting.
So Apple has long tried to get developers to follow their design decisions, especially when it comes to iOS. But Microsoft is exactly the kind of company that would absolutely not care what Apple wants them to do.
No, they're saying, this is our brand. We decide what it looks like.
And that makes sense to me. And the way they are offering the Office app and the Outlook app within that, it makes sense that they would kind of want you to know that you're in their ecosystem now.
Right. And like I said, I think it's an interesting idea to have your kind of work life cordoned off in a separate app. I think that makes a lot of sense. So even if it is a little jarring, it's kind of supposed to be.
Yeah, and I've seen a lot of people do that, not necessarily with OWA for iPhone, but using different email apps, because there are probably hundreds in the App Store, using different apps for different accounts.
Right. Cool. All right. Well, with that, should we turn on our afterburners and move a little more quickly? Do you have your seatbelt on?
Seatbelt on. I'm ready to go. Let's go.
All right, Google Chrome now has an app launcher built into it, so you can run any of the Chrome apps that you like. They come with this kind of mini start menu kind of thing. If you're interested in that, just wait for it, the latest update to Chrome. Or you can always check out the Chrome developer builds called Canary is the latest and greatest one. So it seems kind of interesting. You can launch your, you know, Feedly and Gmail and Google Drive and all that kind of stuff straight from your taskbar in Windows.
Cool, yeah, but it's only for Windows. There's no Linux or OS X support yet.
Yeah, we don't know quite yet, and it's been in Chrome OS for some time now.
Right, sure, of course. Now, Yelp is launching a new platform that is going to allow people to order things. They're starting with food delivery and pickup. It's already available in a select number of restaurants in a select number of cities. If you live in New York or San Francisco and you really like Harry's Italian Pizza Bar or Layali Mediterranean Grill, you can already order food directly through Yelp. But it's a full, openly available platform, so it should be launching elsewhere pretty soon.
That's a great idea. I love the idea of looking at a restaurant on Yelp and saying, I want this now. Click. It's a great idea.
Yeah, I'm sure a lot of people will like it.
So VLC for iOS has returned, says the article. July 19th is when it returns. So we're podcasting after that, so it should be available now.
Great. HTC has announced the One Mini. This is a 4.3-inch sort of little brother of the HTC One. What are some of the specs here, Chris?
So, oddly enough, the Mini is 4.3 inches, which is a little odd, isn't it?
I think that was the case with the Galaxy S4 Mini as well.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's 100% correct. So, the HTC One was clocking in at 4.7 inches. The Mini is 4.3. And it looks like a pretty nice little device. You know, it's got a little bit of the older internals. I'm not sure I'd call this low end, but it's certainly not a flagship device, but, it seems like a pretty decent looking phone. It's got the same kind of design of the shell around it. And I think it's a pretty nice looking phone. It's got 341 pixels per inch because it's 720p at 4.3 inches. So, not the flagship, but pretty nice for people who want a phone that is not a ping pong paddle.
Yeah, not bad. And I would say it's definitely better equipped than the Galaxy S4 Mini.
Yeah, I definitely say that as well.
But speaking of Samsung, since we have not gone a show this year without a Samsung product announcement, they have launched what I believe to be the first consumer-grade terabyte solid-state drive.
Nice.
This is it's a new semi-pro line. It's going to be a little bit more expensive than their fantastic, highly rated, award-winning 840 series. This series is going to be called the 840 Evo, and it's their fastest drives yet. And actually, paradoxically, as your solid-state drive gets bigger, its read and write performance gets faster. So this terabyte drive can push out 520 to 540 megabytes of data per second. Which is about the maximum capability of the SATA connection that you attach it to.
And so that's 98,000 IOPS.
Yeah. So it's going to be available, you know, if you want a smaller one, you can get it in 120 gigabytes or 250, 500, 750. And again, I'm pretty sure that this is the first consumer-oriented terabyte solid-state drive.
Yeah, it's the first I've seen, at least. So Microsoft is slashing the price on its Windows RT tablet, the Surface RT, and it looks like they made too many of them. They didn't sell as many as they were expecting to, it looks like, and they're actually going to start taking a loss on some of these devices. So there's been some speculation that they're also going to release a new version sometime soon. But for now, if you were interested in the Surface RT, you've got the 32 gig model down to $350. And the 64 gig model down to $450.
Nice.
Yeah, that's a pretty good tablet for that price.
It totally is. And they've only been out for 9 months, so we probably won't see a new one for a little while. Yeah. And it is a really great price. It's a lot cheaper than an iPad, and it's bigger.
Yeah, that's for sure. All right, are we ready to turn off the afterburners?
I am ready.
Okay, we can slow down. We'll take a sipping of the tech news from here on out in the podcast. So I found an interesting one. Actually, Josh Pollard of the Digital Media Zone found an interesting one. And this is cool. It's a $99 ARM PC that'll run either Ubuntu or Android. And this thing, you could put it in the class with the Raspberry Pi, but it's got a more powerful processor in it. So this thing looks extremely interesting. I could really go for some XBMC on this device and see what it looks like to use this thing as a home theater PC or something like that.
Yeah, this thing is pretty capable. It's amazing how small it is and the specs that you can put on it. You can get up to 512 gigabytes of SSD storage built in.
Yeah, and of course it's got USB ports, so you can throw some external drives on there too.
Of course.
So, I don't know. It's interesting because it's just a general purpose computer. You know, it's just a Linux computer. So you could do all kinds of things with this, whatever you want. But what I'm looking at it for is media center replacement territory. So, you know, for $99, I might just get one of these things and see what happens. I mean, it's a fully capable Linux computer for the same price as an Apple TV. I mean, that's bonkers.
It is pretty bonkers. I don't know, Chris. I might wait for the second generation one of these, though.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean. I mean, for $99, okay. Now, it's worth noting, it's a little bit confusing. The article we're linking to says that you can get a single, dual, or quad-core edition of this, and it's likely to be the weakest variant that is going to actually be $99. So I do wonder if you'd actually want to upgrade that for media playback and the like.
Yeah, well, it depends on how much it costs, right? A single-core ARM Cortex-A9 would not necessarily be powerful enough to be a full-scale media center.
Yeah, probably not. But anyway, I just wanted to pass it along because I'm extremely excited about this one, and I can't wait to see what people end up doing with it.
Yeah, it's really cool. It's an exciting new product. Like I said, I would wait for second generation, and then I think this is going to be a blockbuster.
Yeah, so we'll see what happens.
All right, so I wanted to give an update on the Galaxy S4 Active. This was their shockproof, dustproof, waterproof version of the Samsung Galaxy S4, and it's now been reviewed by a couple of different media outlets, and the reviews are overwhelmingly very positive. It's a full-powered, full-featured Android phone with few, if any, trade-offs from the original Galaxy S4. The minor trade-offs would be the camera is not as powerful. It's a little bit bigger, which is not really a problem if you were going to get an S4 anyway. And it's only available in the U.S. on AT&T, or I think you could buy it unlocked and probably put it on T-Mobile, but that's about it. So it's GSM only. And they have completely replaced the screen, which was surprising to me because the 1080p 5-inch AMOLED screen on the S4 was a big selling point, but they managed to keep it 1080p and then replace it with LCD, which does much better in direct light. Apparently, the direct light performance on this is about as good as any other phone on the market. And they have this other cool feature where from the screen locked and off, you can use the volume button to turn on the LED flash as a flashlight.
Yeah, that's kind of neat.
Yeah.
So this is a very interesting phone. I think this is not something that the tech and gadget community is going to rally around, but there's something really practical about a phone that you can spill water on, you know, and still be the same good phone that is the Galaxy S4.
Exactly. That's what I was going at here. This is a top-of-the-line flagship phone with very few compromises. And it's really an astounding value for someone who spends a lot of times outdoors or maybe near water or is just generally clumsy and always putting their phone in water. Or I don't know, if you spend a lot of time on the beach, it's dust proof, so you're not going to get sand in the phone.
Yeah. It really calls into question whether or not some of these phones should be, you know, chiseled out of a single piece of aluminum with a fragile glass front. You know, this seems like a good idea. The making these phones more resilient to damage is key. I mean, how many people do you see walking around with cracked screens?
More and more. That's the answer.
Well, because more and more people are getting smartphones, and all of them are fragile. So right. I'm glad to see someone, in fact, one of the biggest smartphone players in the industry, is thinking about doing something else other than this kind of fragile, over-designed kind of phone and making a really pragmatic phone that everybody would probably like. So I'm encouraged by this.
Yeah, totally.
All right, well, I wanted to pass along a little bit of a wacky one. We won't spend too much time on this, but I thought this was kind of interesting. It's a byproduct of all of us having smartphones in our pockets. So there's a company out there that works for a bunch of retail stores, including Nordstrom, amongst other pretty big names. And they have technology that will pay attention to the Wi-Fi and figure out where you are and where you're going and how long you stand in front of displays and that kind of data. And then they're taking all of that data, which is, by the way, in most cases anonymized, so you don't have to worry about your privacy so much with this. But they're taking all of this data and analyzing it and using it to design their store displays and that kind of thing. So I think that's interesting. So if you turn your Wi-Fi off, they can't really do this to you. But because it's so convenient to leave the Wi-Fi on and searching for a signal, your phone just kind of pings and says, you know, is there anyone out there? And the router responds and says, oh, yes, I'm here. Look at me. And then they can triangulate your location. So that's a really interesting outcome, because you've got people with devices in their pocket that are just kind of radiating messages, and if you put a router in there and snip up the messages, then they can track you around the store and get some data about what you're up to. So, you know, this isn't any Big Brother kind of tracking like we've seen recently, but I thought that was kind of interesting.
Right. This is technology that has been around for a while, but it's just not the kind of thing that you think of when you're walking through a store. You don't expect there to be a camera tracking your phone through Wi-Fi.
Right, and I suppose there is some minor privacy concerns here, because they have the ability to uniquely identify the radio. So, you know, there is potential for some tracking here, but that's not really what they're talking about. But yeah, it's interesting. So if you're concerned about that, then if you just turn off your Wi-Fi, you're probably okay.
Yeah, well, I'm sure that they will find a way around that soon enough.
Yeah, I'm sure they will. All right, well, let's find a way around our energy consumption crisis. What do we got?
Well, good news. The market is finding a way around it before us. Now, this is a new report from the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. Every year, they release a report saying how much energy the U.S. uses and where all that energy comes from, what sort of power plants are providing this electricity generation, and then petroleum for transportation and industrial and commercial uses as well. And what they found is over the last few years, each year the total energy consumption has been going down, and over the last 2 years, the amount of cleaner energy as a portion of the whole has been increasing. Now, a lot of that is due to cheap natural gas, which a lot of it comes from hydraulic fracturing, which has its own downsides. But just in terms of carbon emissions, our energy is getting cleaner and we are using less of it for the past few years in a row. But then they weren't sure that this was because all of our sources combined were getting cleaner. In fact, for the first few years, it wasn't. We were using a lot more coal for a while. But then they blamed the decrease in energy on the recession. Now, this is the first year that our national GDP has gone up, indicating that the decrease in energy use is not a result of the recession. It's actually a result of, as a country, we are consuming electricity more efficiently. And so it's good news, right?
Yeah,
good things are happening in the green tech world.
So it's cool. Natural gas is at 26% and coal is at 17.4. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, so, as little as 2 years ago, it was farther in the other direction.
So it's cool. It's interesting. They split it up. So while natural gas is 26% and coal 17.4, specifically for generating electricity, you can see coal dwarfing natural gas 15.9 to 9.3. So that's kind of interesting. So in the sphere of generating electricity to go across the wire, coal wins. But in general energy consumption, natural gas wins.
Right. And you can see how little of our natural gas and biomass and electric production goes into transportation. It's still
still massive.
It's very largely petroleum based.
Now, I like this little, if you follow the petroleum, by the way, we've got a link in the show notes for people wondering what we're talking about. And there's a fantastic diagram of where all of this happens.
Yeah, and they do it every year. And some people really geek out about this. They'll compare different years, and they create infographics that'll show you how each energy source shifts from one sector to another over years. People really like these graphs every year.
Here's the one that I like. So if you follow petroleum, you've got a little tiny wisp of it coming up at 0.218% that actually gets fed into electricity generation. So there's some tiny amount of, you know, gas generators out there that are contributing to that number. That's kind of funny.
Oh, yeah. There are a couple of petroleum power plants out there. And then generators are counted separately.
Yeah, so that's pretty cool. All right, well, let's get into the tip of the week. What do you got for us?
The tip of the week this week comes from Lifehacker, as it often does. And it is it has to do with the new interface for Gmail. If you have turned on Gmail in the last few weeks, maybe you've had it for a while, maybe you just got it, they have this new tabbed interface that we've talked about before. But one of the new things, since they released it to the public, is that they put ads in there that go into the same space as your email. So it looks like an email. And you might be confused by that. You might be wondering what's going on, or you might just be mildly annoyed. Now, Lifehacker has a step-by-step that will eliminate these email ads, you know, these ads masquerading as emails in your inbox. It's pretty simple. You just click settings in your Gmail, you select configure inbox, and then you deselect the promotions tab and then click save. That's it.
Cool. So I haven't encountered this quite yet. I do have the new Gmail, but I haven't encountered this kind of advertisement quite yet. So if I do, I'll come back to our show notes and follow this guide. That's cool.
Well, you might as well just go ahead and do it before you see
it. Do it preemptively.
Right.
Yeah, that makes sense. All right, now I've got an app pick of the week for us. So this happened a few weeks ago, but Opera 15 has been released. So what they're doing with this release is they're moving to the WebKit rendering engine, which is the one that Chrome uses. And they're also trying to move toward a faster release cycle, just like Firefox and Chrome have done. So, you know, what is Chrome up at? Version 2600 by now, I'm sure?
I have no idea.
Opera's going to adopt a very similar release cadence. So I'm kind of excited to see what happens. And I downloaded the very first version of it here, and it looks pretty good. You know, they've got some edges to smooth out, but I really like what I see. They've got the same kind of minimal interface that Chrome is famously brought to the web. And I'm kind of encouraged. This is a real competitor to Chrome and WebKit in this case. So I like what I see so far.
Yeah, I haven't had a chance to check this out, but I have been using a little bit of Opera for iOS, which I believe has been WebKit-based for a while.
All right, and let's move on to our last story of the week. What do we have here?
The kicker this week is a human-powered helicopter.
How is that possible?
It is barely possible by someone who is very lightweight with very strong legs for about 1 minute.
Wow, that's impressive.
This is a competition that has been running for 33 years. Several teams have been trying to do it. A front runner was an engineering team at the University of Maryland who have come very close in two attempts in the last 2 years. But it was a Canadian team that has finally accomplished it last week. That they hit the minimum requirements that you have to hover at 10 feet or above for 1 full minute. And so they found a very accomplished cyclist to pedal very hard for a minute or so in order to achieve that, along with a giant, very lightweight structure in order to achieve lift. Now, there have been human-powered, bicycle-powered planes before, and those can go a little bit farther. But this one, it only weighs 120 pounds.
Wow.
It's 47 meters wide. And it was able to hover in place above 10 feet for a minute.
Neat. Yeah, that's the key, is you have to hover to be a helicopter.
Right.
So you really got to click through in the show notes and look at the photo of this thing. It's pretty impressive.
Yeah, I'm really hoping that they release the video soon, because this photo was, in fact, just a screenshot from the video that has not yet been released.
Yeah, I can't wait for that. Well, if that comes out, we'll make it our kicker again.
Right. And all that netted them about $250,000.
Yeah, that's really cool looking. I can't imagine. That guy must be quite the cyclist and quite light, like you said.
Yes, he must be. They determined that you need a very high power-to-weight ratio.
So, Taylor, if somebody were to try to contact you from a helicopter, how would they go about doing so?
They could probably just fly over to my house. You know, it makes a lot of noise. It kicks up a lot of wind. Maybe if they have a megaphone or a gun, preferably not a gun. A spotlight, that would be fun.
That would be pretty good.
So yeah, spotlight. I'm going to go with spotlight.
Okay, spotlight. So mm-hmm. What's your spotlight username?
Hey, over here! Over here!
That sounds about
it's
right.
It's me, Taylor. That's my spotlight username.
Okay, we'll give you one more plug. How would somebody get at you on Twitter?
On Twitter, they could just tweet me. That's how these things go. I mean, I guess you could send me one of those private messages, but I'd have to be following you first. So you could just tweet me.
And your username is?
At TaylorPhone.
All right. And if you wanted to get at me, I am at Chris Hale Barnes. And together, we are the end user. So
the end user. Right?
Yeah. So if you have any feedback about the show, let us know right over there. All right. So that'll do it for this week. It was very fun.
Yes, it was fun.
So thank you, everyone, for listening to the show. And, of course, you can find more information, including the show notes, at thedigitalmediazone.com under the end user. That's THENDUSR. The DMZ has a few other podcasts. You can have a listen to Entertainment 2.0, Scene in HD, the movie podcast, and the newest podcast, Home On. And you can send us some feedback. Our email is theenduser@thedigitalmediazone.com. Or, like I mentioned, you can ping us on Twitter. We are @theenduser. You can join us in the chat room as we record the show live every Monday night at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. We almost didn't make it this week, but the podcast prevailed. I am your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime, Taylor Mott.
Thanks for listening, folks. We will see you next week. Bye-bye.
Hey! Hey, over here! Hey, helicopter!